You could be watching the new Spider-Man. You could be just relaxing at home, watching TV, but you decided to come and to listen and to engage tonight in an important topic. So we're glad that you came. My name is Todd Sherman. I'm the pastor at the church that the Rich Community Church is putting this on. And a lot of people ask, why would a church put something like this on, where you get to hear from two opposing views on such a pivotal topic, an important one in our culture, I believe, and one that many people are passionate about. Well, we feel that the church has gone to one extreme or the other, where they've either said, no, we don't want to deal with anything with science, we'll just kind of leave that there and go do our thing, the faith thing, or the other extreme, where it's real combative in right in people's face, and we've decided to say, we want to provide an atmosphere where people can come and talk about such important issues as how we began and what happens after this life and all the things that will be brought up tonight with our speakers. So we are glad that you came. I'm here just to moderate, to set the table a little bit, and then we'll get to what you all came for, hearing from these guys. Tonight we have some expectations, one from the speakers. Our expectations of them, the reason why you came is because they've put a lot of work in this. They've studied. They've done the hard work to learn and grow in this area. And so you want to hear their thoughts. And so we're going to listen to them, communicate their views on the topic. They're going to interact with each other. We're going to have some fun. It's going to be 10 minutes that they get to present their case and then Q&A. So there's going to be a lot of interaction back and forth. They're going to interact with you during that Q&A, so you have time to ask those questions. And so your job, going to you, is first to be respectful. This is an atmosphere of respect where we have civil disagreement. Some of you came because you're curious about the topic, so you're probably not going to get too upset or too into it. Some of you are very passionate about the topic, and so you might get a little upset, a little passionate when somebody on the other view is sharing what they think is the truth. And so we just ask you to be respectful. We're not going to have applause during the debate. We're obviously not going to have jeering, depending on what part of the country you're with. No booing, no whistling, no taking off your sandals and chucking them at any time. Let's keep all our footwear on tonight. Again, we don't expect to have an issue, but because people are passionate about this topic, we might on both sides. And so we're just asking you to listen, to engage. After the 40 minutes, after they each have 10 minutes, then we will applaud and say, well done. And then during the Q&A is your time to interact. And so yeah, hopefully everybody got a program, and you see the schedule. Obviously, we're just a few minutes behind. But during that Q&A, we have two ways that you can put up your questions. One is you have that QR code, or you can go to the YouVersion site there. I guess it's just through the QR code there. So if you have a smartphone, you can just go to that site, push your question in as soon as a question comes to mind. And Kevin will be going through those questions and putting them all together for when we ask them questions. So if you're old school, don't have a smartphone, you got a pen and a note card, and so after the 40 minutes, we'll collect those questions, and Kevin will get those. And so what we're going to do our best is to throw them to different speakers. So if you have a question, let's say Stu said something during his presentation, you have a specific question for him, write his name at the top and then write that question. Then Stu will have 2 minutes to respond, and then each of the other speakers will have a minute to throw in anything they want to. So that's the format with that. Now I just want to introduce you to our speakers. To our right, we have the two men who are defending the worldview of naturalism or Darwinian evolution. To the far right is Norman Schultz. He is the philosophy instructor at Metropolitan State University of Denver and has taught philosophy and writing courses for over 10 years at several area community colleges and the School of Mines. He has his master's in philosophy from CU Boulder and a BA in philosophy from San Diego State. He is the co-host of the Mile High Sanity Project and podcast host of Norm's Conceptual Corner. Let's welcome Norm Schultz. Next to him is Professor Michael Tooley. He's the professor of philosophy at CU Boulder since 1992. He has his bachelor's from the University of Toronto and a PhD from Princeton University. He has authored several books, including Knowledge of God and a book called Time, Tense, and Causation, and has done many debates, including a debate on the existence of God with William Lane Craig. Let's all welcome Professor Tooley. On our left, defending intelligent design, the one closest to me is Professor Douglas Groteis. Dr. Groteis has been a professor of philosophy and ethics at Denver Seminary since 1993. He got his PhD in philosophy at the University of Oregon and has published 12 books, including Christian Apologetics, A Comprehensive Case for Biblical Faith and Truth, and also Truth Decay. And he's written numerous articles, book reviews, and editorials. Let's welcome Dr. Groteis. Next to him is Stu Richard. Stu has studied astronomy back at the University of Chicago, and then got his master's in curriculum and instruction from the University of Colorado in 1987. He taught for 37 years at Thornton High School, and during his tenure, he taught International Baccalaureate Theory of Knowledge for 17 years and IB Philosophy for 15 of those years, as well as being a Fulbright Scholar in Egypt in 2003-2004. Let's welcome Mr. Richard. Okay, here's what you all came for. We're going to hear their views. Tonight's topic is, which is a more viable worldview, intelligent design, or Darwinian evolution? Each speaker at the beginning is going to give 10 minutes. We drew names at the beginning. And to start tonight is Professor Norman Schultz, who again will have 10 minutes, and then it will be Professor Groteis, then Professor Tooley, and then Mr. Richard to end the first 40 minutes. So welcome, Mr. Schultz.
Start out by thanking our hosts. I greatly appreciate the invitation to participate in this. Thank everybody in the audience. I think it's a good thing for people to get together in honesty to talk about important matters, and so this kind of thing probably doesn't happen enough. With that, I want to start off with a few notes of clarification from my perspective. One is that the event is referred to as a war of the worldviews, evolution versus intelligent design. And for me personally, I would argue that evolution is not a worldview. And I'll talk about what are the worldviews at issue here, but why is evolution not a worldview? Well, being a philosopher, I'm interested in the way words are used. So I would say there are two ways that the word evolution can be used, and it's very similar to the way that the word gravity can be used. If you talk about gravity, there are two things you could be talking about. You could be talking about what happens when you drop something, or when you look at the orbit of a planet. Or you could be talking about the scientific theory that explains that. I think those are the two central ways that you can use that term. The same applies to evolution. You could be talking about what has actually happened. And when you're talking about that, it's not only not a worldview, it's not even a theory at that point. It's just a statement about what has happened. Then there is the theory of evolution, which intends to explain how that works. And so those are really two different things. We have to be careful how we use these terms. So I want to talk about evolution as both something that happened and something that is an explanation of what has happened. But I actually won't talk about that very much because of the fact of neither of those is really a worldview. I think that what's really going on in a discussion like this, and it's perfectly legitimate that it's going on, is that there is a set of worldviews that is at issue, but it's not actually evolution. The real topic is religion. That's the real reason why we have these discussions, and I think one way or the other, that's the real reason why we're here. So I like to talk about what is really going on and not the superficial kinds of things. And the reason why I think religion is really what is at issue here is for several reasons. One is evolution is, as far as a theory, by some accounts, the most well-supported theory in the history of science. It's the bedrock of all modern biology. There's a great number of things in modern biology that don't make any sense without evolution. And it has ties to many other scientific fields, from chemistry to astronomy, medicine, behavioral sciences, and many others. It's been around for over 150 years in its formal state, and in that time, it has been pounced on from every direction, as every scientific theory is, through rigorous peer review, attacks from all sides, repeated testing, and yet it is not only still around, but it is just gaining more and more support. I think on the handout, by the way, did everybody get my handout? I hope so. If you didn't, I have some more copies. But it might be a little late now. In the handout, I mentioned that something like 97 to 99.8% of scientists accept the theory of evolution. And it becomes, it's the case that the more of an expert you are, the more you tend to accept evolution. So the people who are in the appropriate sciences, which would be earth and life sciences, by some measurements, over 99% of them accept evolution. So for that reason, I feel like what happens when people don't accept evolution is it's not for a scientific reason. It's for another reason. And I think what that reason is because it offends people's religious beliefs. And that is completely understandable. If you think about evolution, outside of the vacuum of all of the noise that is going on, it's a very weird idea. It is not intuitive. And it can be affronting to our place in the universe. As a matter of fact, Sigmund Freud said, kind of famously said, that there were three affronts to human dignity by science. The first was Copernicus, who figured out that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. That lowered us in status. The next was Darwin, because he proposed that human beings were animals. And then Freud, in classic academic fashion, said that he was the third affront, because not only were we animals, but we are sick animals. So, but I think he's got a point regarding evolution in that it does lower our status. It lowers our view of our place in the universe. It puts us on par with what we might refer to as animals or beasts. And that can be easily offended. So I think that the underlying current is really what is at issue. And so what I really want to talk about is how we form our beliefs. In fact, I'd like a show of hands. I'm interested in knowing if you consider yourself a non. And here's what that means. A non is someone who is either atheist, agnostic, or would check the box for spiritual but not religious. So it means non-religious. Raise your hand if you are here and you are non-religious. Okay. So look around and notice how few hands there are. I think there's a reason for this. And the reason is that these kinds of debates are ultimately people who feel disenfranchised with their beliefs and are looking to gain traction in them, looking to legitimize them. And so I want to talk about that. I want to talk about creationism, which I'm guessing from the feel of the religiosity of the room that most people here believe in some form of creation. And so what I'd like to ask is, how did you arrive at that belief? I'm open to answers, by the way, during the discussion, but I'm going to make a guess, because I used to be religious and I used to be a creationist. I think my guess is that this was not learned by a scientific process. Creationism was probably learned in church or from your family or just from your community. It was not part of a personal scientific inquiry. And so what I believe has happened is people arrive at a belief in creationism, and then they become emotionally attached to it. as well as, I'm not sure what, exactly the right term I want to use, but invested in it personally. For many reasons, because that's what religions will do. Religions associate your belief in creationism with other beliefs that are emotionally and personally charged, such as the virtue of being faithful and not being a doubter. The fact that if you were to question, that this would be seen as a character flaw. The fact that your social spheres are mostly people of your same religion or a similar religious background. The idea that your immortal soul is tied up in your beliefs, and therefore you have a fear to question them at risk of what might happen to you after you die. None of these leads to being objective and being able to look at, I think, really any question with a view to answering it. Never mind a scientific question like our origins or the origins of life. So, regardless of what happens in a debate format like this, I think that if a person really wants to honestly answer these kinds of questions, they first have to get themselves in a position to be able to see them objectively. Which for me, when I was religious, was very difficult. I didn't start actually genuinely questioning these things until I was in my late 20s. Because that was when I finally found myself in an environment where it was okay to question. And I found that in college, but everybody has their own journey, right? They can find it at whatever point they are. So that's the main point that I want to make, is how do you form beliefs? What is the method, and is that a reliable method? And just about out of time, but I have a lot more to say about methods of forming beliefs. If anybody has any questions, hopefully I'll get a chance to talk about them more. Thank you.
Well, welcome everyone. Thank you for being here. The title of my talk is Challenging Darwinism. Is there scientific evidence against Darwinism and for intelligent design? I come neither to bury Darwin nor to praise him, but to challenge him on the basis of the evidence. In the first presentation, we received exactly zero evidence for Darwinism, except a lot of smart people believe it. So let me talk first of all about what I mean by evolution. First of all, evolution can mean simply change over time. Not challenging that. It can mean change within species. This is microevolution. It can mean three, all species evolve from a common ancestor. This is called macroevolution. Or four, this is what I'm going to target, all life on Earth is the result of undirected natural causes. That's the Darwinist claim. Now, what is distinctive about Darwinism, and how does it incorporate a worldview? The claim is that the entire biosphere can be explained by material and undirected, that is, blind causes. This is what Richard Dawkins calls the blind watchmaker thesis. The claim further is that natural selection works on random variations in organisms produced by genetic mutations, and that this is the major factor in producing descent with modification. This is not artificial selection, such as plant breeding or dog breeding, but natural selection, meaning natural as in unintelligent causation, no design. So natural selection and some of the associated mechanisms that are posited to explain Darwinism functions as a designer substitute. And that is a metaphysical claim. That is, there is no design in the biosphere. So the question is whether we have sufficient evidence to claim there is no design detectable in the biosphere. Now, can Darwin and Darwinism be challenged scientifically? Yes. Criticisms have come from scientists and philosophers on the basis of empirical evidence from the time of Darwin on. These criticisms do not need to apply any religious test or apply any religious text to to the argument. I certainly do not. Now, what is the challenge to this Darwinian worldview? One challenge is that of intelligent design. Let me quote Wayne Dembski on this. There exists natural systems that cannot be adequately explained in terms of undirected natural causes and that exhibit features which in any other circumstance we would attribute to intelligence. That's from his book, The Design Revolution. So the objective of intelligent design is not to verify the book of Genesis or to induce a religious experience. It is to provide some evidence to question Darwinism at the biochemical or other levels and provide some evidence for design as a better scientific explanation. So the pattern of reasoning is called inference to the best explanation. It has nothing to do with taking anything on blind faith or what your emotions were or what your religious background was or was not. So let me try to briefly explain this. Second point, the science of design detection in nature. Now this is a challenge to philosophical materialism, which is the attempt to explain the entire world of life without any originating intelligent causes whatsoever. So any intelligence that exists is evolved, not original. Now let me give you a concept called specified complexity. And this is slide 9, if we can have that. This is very significant to the inference to the best explanation. Specified complexity has to do with improbable things that are complex that fit a recognizable pattern, such as Scrabble pieces, spelling out words, or the arrangement of the heads on Mount Rushmore. So this is an indication of intelligent design, not merely unintelligent causation. This pattern of finding design is used in forensic science, in criminology, in archaeology, finding artifacts, in cryptography, deciphering codes, and also trying to find intelligent signals from outer space, should they exist, a second project. So the inference tries to eliminate chance and natural law as capable of achieving the total effect of the object that is claimed to be specified and complex. That is, neither chance by itself, because of the high improbability, nor law by itself, nor the combination of chance and law are sufficient to explain specified complexity. So that would leave as an explanation on the basis of the evidence, on the basis of the reasoning that is used in other areas of science all the time, outside of biology. That would leave as a conclusion an intelligent cause as the best scientific explanation, some kind of mind, not a mere mindless, unintelligent piece of matter or collection of matter. Now let me give you one example of specified complexity. It is a molecular machine called the bacterial flagellum. And if we could put up slide 31 on this. This is a very complicated device, something like an outboard motor. It has a universal joint. What is my time? I can't see. 2 minutes. It has a universal joint, a propeller, a drive shaft, and so on. It has all the indications of specified complexity that is the mark of intelligence. But it's biological. No human being made this. And it's an example of a type of specified complexity called irreducible complexity, or the mousetrap principle. All the integrated parts are needed for the fruitful function of powering a bacterium around in the cell. It is very improbable, statistically, that it was built up gradually through natural selection, because it has to have all these parts working at the same time to convey the function of powering the bacterium through the cell. So the argument here, going so quickly, is not that the Bible tells me that the bacterial flagellum is designed. It's looking at the evidence of what it is and the possible origin of it, and the inference is that a designing intelligence is a better explanation than chance and natural law or some combination of chance and natural law. Now, some people will say this just isn't science at all. And there's a philosophical move here called methodological naturalism. We will not accept designing intelligence as an explanation for science, period. Well, that is a very closed narrow view of scientific investigation. This presupposes a view of science that says, science pursues material, unintelligent explanations for natural phenomena through empirical observation and rational theorizing. That's a worldview. That presupposes a naturalistic view of the world, and it doesn't leave open the possibility of falsification. So, I advance an alternative understanding of science, which is, science pursues the best explanation for natural phenomena through empirical observation and rational theorizing. This may or may not include causes that are not entirely explicable on naturalistic grounds. That is, this may include intelligent causes. That is, it may include intelligent design. So you gather the evidence, you look at what you're observing, whether it's the bacterial flagellum or the informational nature of DNA and RNA, and you say, how can we account for this entity or this organism and this system? And then you do an inference. Is it better to assume, not assume, but to conclude through reasoning that it's simply the result of unintelligent material causes, or is it a better inference, inferences used in other aspects of science to say, no, it gives the sign of intelligence. So we should follow the empirical evidence wherever it leads, not rule out a design inference in principle, and not assume that everyone who challenges Darwinism does so for irrational religious reasons.
Naturalism or Christian supernaturalism, which is true. So first let me define naturalism. This is not methodological naturalism. Naturalism is the view that there is no immaterial mind such as God that exists outside the universe we inhabit and miraculously intervenes in our world. Two claims. First, this is one. Naturalism thus defined is an empirical claim and one for which there is excellent evidence. Claim two. Christian supernaturalism is a view against which there is extremely strong empirical evidence. It also is open to moral criticism and involves worshiping a deeply immoral deity who, among other things, will allow most of the human race to suffer eternal torment in hell. So next, section one, clearing away confusion about worldviews. Norm's already talked about this, so I'll be very brief. The point is that neither so-called intelligent design nor the theory of evolution is a worldview. Both of those views can be combined with many worldviews. The two different worldviews that are at stake tonight are, in most general terms, naturalism on one hand and supernaturalism on the other. But our opponents in this debate are not just supernaturalists, they're also Christians. So what is being debated here tonight is therefore a lot of naturalism versus Christian supernaturalism. Section two. I want to mention some claims, some of which you've already heard and others which you will hear, which you may find very tempting, but which are clearly false claims and show you have to be careful not to be taken in by them. The first false claim is this, that naturalism is a philosophical thesis. The fact is that naturalism is not a philosophical thesis. It's an empirical proposition about the world. Specifically, as I've just said, it's a thesis that reality does not contain any immaterial minds or persons who are actually intervening in a world of space and time. Second claim you may encounter is that naturalism is a matter of faith to which naturalists are irrevocably attached. This, again, is not the case. Naturalism is not a matter of faith. Those of us who hold that naturalism is true can very easily imagine events such that if those events were to occur, we would conclude that naturalism is false and supernaturalism is true. Those of us who accept the thesis of naturalism, as Norm and I do so precisely because there is extremely strong evidence for that thesis. Another false claim, naturalism involves an acceptance of what's called scientific materialism. Scientific materialism is the view that nothing exists outside of what is involved in physics. Some naturalists do accept scientific materialism, Others, such as myself, do not. Naturalism is logically completely compatible, for example, with the false hypothesis that humans have immaterial minds. It's also completely compatible with the quite plausible view that consciousness, both human consciousness and that of animals, is not reducible to the stuff of physics. It's also compatible with the view that reality contains objective moral values that are not reducible to physics. False claim four, Christian supernaturalism is compatible with science and with history. The fact is, as we shall see, Christian supernaturalism is incompatible both with very well-established scientific theories and also with firmly established scientific historical facts. Okay, I'll skip on now to re-intervention very quickly, recommended reading for those of you who are interested. A book that I would highly recommend is Kevin Miller's book, Fighting God Is Gone. There's a chapter, God and Mechanic, which deals in detail with intelligent design. Dr. Grotheis mentions this book very, very briefly in his book, Christian Apologetics, the Roman Two Footings. So section three, the empirical evidence against Christian supernaturalism. One of the crucial pieces of evidence is what's known as the argument from evil. And what the argument from evil says, if you look at the suffering that you find in the world, both human and animal and so on, then that represents extremely good evidence for the view that God does not exist. It's evidence that makes it extremely unlikely that God does not exist. And I developed this argument at great length in a big volume, Knowledge of God, with Professor Alvin Plantinga at that time in Notre Dame. Second point is that the apparent design that you see in the world is not accurately characterized as intelligent. I mentioned a number of things here, but focus, for example, on the human spine. Many of you, I suspect, know people who have suffered enormously because of back injuries and so on. It's extremely common, right? If you were an engineer, I would be willing to bet that you could do a very good job of designing a spine that wasn't subject to these problems, right? So the design is not intelligent. The interesting point is number four. There's a gene that humans have that makes it the case that women are more susceptible to lung cancer than men, even if they haven't smoked. Final point I mention here, consider sexual maturity. Fact is, sexual maturity precedes by a number of years full emotional maturity, and ask yourself how much harm that essentially does. Then there are design faults in the world outside of human beings. There's the existence of carnivorous animals. If you're a antelope and so on, right? Then you might realize that the prospect of being beaten by a lion and so on is not a very attractive prospect. So there's an enormous amount of suffering in the world because there are carnivorous animals. Another example, a very simple one, there are plants that are both very harmful and highly addictive. Suppose you could snap your finger right now and you could wipe the tobacco plant off the surface of the earth forever and ever. Or suppose that you could eliminate the opium poppy. Would anyone really hesitate to do that? So we have these things that are extremely harmful to the world, again, which are very strong evidence against the existence of a being that's all-powerful, all-knowing, and perfectly good. On to point three, supernaturalism and immaterial human minds. Not all Christians accept the idea of immaterial human minds, but Dr. Grotheis certainly does. And again, there are a number of empirical facts to make the existence of immaterial minds extremely unlikely. And so it's no accident, for example, that if you take a course in university in psychology, the probability you'll encounter the view that the human mind is immaterial is really very, very small. But, you know, there's massive evidence. And one simple thing, for example, is the case of brain damage. Consider people who get shot or who have strokes and so on. Not only does that affect your psychological functioning, but how it affects it depends upon what part of the brain was injured. Now, if the mind just is the brain, then that makes perfectly good sense. But if the mind is some sort of immaterial substance communicating with the brain, then it's just unintelligible why injuries to different parts of the brain will have different effects on psychological functions. Point four, common descent. The idea is that humans are descended from non-human primates. An excellent book on this is Relics of Eden by Daniel J. Fairbanks. And what Fairbanks shows is that there's overwhelming DNA evidence that the human race is descended from other primates. Here's an example of one type of evidence. Humans have only 23 chromosomes. Chimpanzees and so on have 24. You might say, well, that looks like good evidence for special creation. But when you look more closely, you find that human chromosome number 2 turns out to be a fusion of two primate chromosomes, right? So there's excellent reason for believing that the human body, so to speak, is descended from other primates. Point 5, consider faith healing. I imagine most people here are Christians and believe in faith healing. But there have been a number of studies of this. One that I mentioned here is a report by the British Medical Association in 1956. And all these studies have resulted in a negative finding, that there is no evidence that faith healing occurs. Consider something else that most of you probably believe in. The idea that prayer is helpful, for example, for someone who's sick, you pray for them. There's a better chance for the better. This has been studied a number of times. The most impressive study is a study of the therapeutic effects of intercessory prayer carried out in 2006. And the conclusion was that such prayer itself had no effect at all on recovery from the operation in question. Point 7, many believe that miracles occur. But there are a number of supposed miracles described, for example, in the Bible, that we give excellent reason for believing did not occur. This includes, for example, the great flood that supposedly occurred at the time of Noah, includes the sun standing still, Joshua battles Jericho, includes the graves being opened and the dead people walking around the city at the time of Jesus' death. Eighth point, final point. Jesus believed in demonic possession and is said to cure people suffering from his illness. Again, there's no evidence for demonic possession. If you went to medical school, you wouldn't be told some illnesses are caused by bacteria and viruses, others are caused by demonic possession. You need to send those patients to a religious person to heal. So there's massive evidence for naturalism and against supernaturalism. Thank you very much.
Props with me. My name's Stu. I don't have any real titles, but I read a lot of books. And I came to know the belief in God through when I was a young kid. I looked up at the stars in the sky, and I started to figure out, wow, there's someone a lot bigger than me to put this all together. And I began to study astronomy, and I was kind of a nerd. Okay, so I had a briefcase that I took to elementary school. So I got beat up a lot. And I started a club. Some of you may have joined me. It's called the Young Astronomers Club of America. So nobody? Okay. I didn't think so. But what I was going to talk about is, could you run up slide 2, please? There was a guy you probably know with some wild flock of white hair, David Albert Einstein. Remember that guy, right? Einstein came up with, in the year 1905, he had this miracle year, and he wrote 4 papers. One of them was called General Relativity. And I actually, as a kid, I kind of was a nerd, so I memorized the equations for general relativity, and later got to kind of experience what, you know, what it would be like if you could figure out what was going on with the universe and all that. And it turns out that Einstein has this classic quote. Says, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. If the universe were the product of irrational, unguided, naturalistic processes, why would I even be able to understand it? How would I even know what's going on? All right? The next thing is C.S. Lewis, who was a doubter, who came to believe in God. His position, he changed. He said, if the whole universe has no meaning, we should have never known that it had no meaning. All right, could you go to the next slide? And Richard Feynman, guys that you may know, Nobel laureate, he wrote a book in which he said, the first principle in science is that you must not fool yourself. And you're the easiest person to fool. Now, scientists have a worldview that they bring with them, whatever you're going to call it. You can call it naturalism, supernaturalism. We bring something to the table. We're human beings. The question is, are we willing to let the evidence speak, or have we made a condition at the beginning that says, no, we're not going to let that one into the ballpark? And that's what I would contend is done in today's science. Now, a lot of these students that I have been taught evolution and been taught that it's a fact. Now, let's talk about this. Sir Arthur Eddington, he was the guy that actually proved Einstein's theory. He figured out that gravity does bend the fabric of space-time. He did that by taking a picture doing a perfect solar eclipse. If you think about that for just a second, the fact that we even have a perfect solar eclipse should strike you as, whoa, that's unusual. If you were on Mars, you wouldn't have that. If you were on Jupiter, you wouldn't have that, but you'd be dead, so you couldn't see it anyway. So, kind of an interesting piece. But perfect solar eclipses happen because the moon is 2,170 miles in diameter. The sun is 865,000 miles in diameter. Okay? About 400 times larger. The moon is about 238,000 miles from the Earth. The sun is 93 million miles from the Earth, about 400 times farther away. It just happens to lock up. If you go to that next one, at the bottom here, you see what's called the flash spectrum. The only reason we know what's going on inside of stars is because of a thing called the flash spectrum. In this, we found out that in the sun, there's this beautiful little dance going on. And I have another slide. If you could go to the one that has James Bond on it, that would be number 34. 007, okay? And what's going on inside of a star is four hydrogen atoms are fusing into two helium atoms and giving off energy. And 7/1000 of the mass of hydrogen is converted into energy. So what? Turns out, if you move that up, 0.008, we're not here, okay? Because it proceeds too efficiently. The fuel burns up too fast, and we're dead. 0.006, we're not here, okay? Go to the next one, please. Back to the top part. Sorry, I'm going fast. I'm trying to get all these in. Number 5. Types of galaxies. When people look out at those pictures that you see Hubble Deep Space Field and you think, wow, look at those billions of galaxies. I bet there's life out there somewhere on one of those planets. They probably have a planet like Earth somewhere because Earth's pretty mediocre. The Copernican principle of mediocrity became known as. Well, it turned out there's some problems. And astronomers have begun to find out galaxies have these issues. What's at the center of every galaxy that we've seen? Supermassive black hole. Supermassive black holes, when matter is pulled into them, emit gamma rays, X-rays, really harmful stuff that would kill any life anywhere near the center of a galaxy. Turns out we're 26,000 light years away from the center of the Milky Way galaxy. So we're shielded, too, by dust. Did you realize dust saves our life? That's kind of cool. So next. Okay. And the different kinds of galaxies. The only kind of galaxy that could actually probably have life, and it would only exist in what's called by astronomers the galactic habitable zone, it's a spiral galaxy like what we live in. Okay? Because in an irregular galaxy, because of the three-body gravity problem, all the stars visit the galactic core, where the bad stuff is. If you get too far away from that center of the galaxy, you don't have enough heavy elements to make terrestrial rock planets. All right, move on to the star. Our sun is a G2 yellow dwarf main sequence star. You can tell I'm a nerd, sorry. You guys probably don't sit at home thinking about this. But it turns out that our sun is among the 10% largest stars in our galaxy. 90% of the stars that you look at and see are red dwarfs. Big problem for life around a red dwarf is no photosynthesis. Okay? Doesn't have the right kind of light. Alright? Move on, please, to the next one, number 7. Jupiter, Saturn, super big gas planets. Okay? Most galaxies and things that we've looked at, if we've looked at with Kepler, we've seen other stars that have, you know, planets orbiting them. the large gas planets have irregular orbits, elliptical orbits, which would throw off the orbits of the little rock life planets in the center, which need to be in the circumstellar habitable zone. They need to be just the right distance from the home star for liquid water. Water's big. Turns out we have Jupiter and Saturn. Jupiter's 338 times the mass of the Earth. And so Jupiter acts like a giant vacuum cleaner. It goes through the solar system, taking the hits that would beat the heck out of us. Like, does anybody see the movie Armageddon? Yeah, okay, that's be happening all the time. Saturn, similar. Saturn's so non-dense, though, that if you had a large enough blast, Saturn would float in. All right, move to number 9. Or let's go to number 11. I'm going to talk real quickly, because I have limited time here, about what are the chances, because this, let's get into this, mathematical probability, okay? What are the chances of producing a single functional protein by chance, okay? We do this a lot in my class. We talk about chance in combinatorial mathematics. If you took every, what, does anybody know that if you took the age of the universe in seconds, how long that would be? 14 billion years would be 10 to the 16th. Okay, then 16 seconds. If you took the matter in the whole universe, number of atoms in the universe, and I've counted every one of them. All right. Turns out that's 10 to the 80th. I gotta find the right one. 10 to the 80th. Okay, so you got 80 of these. 10 to the 16th. If you shuffled every atom in the history of the universe, for every second, the greatest complexity you can produce by chance alone is, you add the exponents, 10 to the 96th. The chances of forming a single functional protein are 10 to the 174th, okay? Which means that couldn't happen. And it gets worse. The case gets way worse. Hemoglobin in your blood. A single hemoglobin molecule would be 10 to the 74th.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Rich is going to be selling jewelry after the you see him back in the hallway. Alright, now it's going to be real rapid fire. We're going to be doing questions. You guys thought the 10 minutes went fast. They're going to have 2 minutes if it's questions specific to one speaker, and then the others will have 1 minute. If it's an all play, they'll each have 2 minutes. So guys are going to be coming down with baskets, and they're going to be collecting the offering now. I'm sorry. I'm a pastor. You're going to be collecting your questions now. So if you're on this side, start passing your questions down to the end. From this side, start passing your questions down to this end. Okay, so gentlemen, with all the craziness beforehand, we did talk about this as far as who gets to speak first, who gets all plays, or when you want to respond. So let's just do it. Now you guys are the students. So raise your hand, first hand I see, I will call on. Will that work? So I can take you back a few years. All right. Mr. Grotes already knows. We're going to start with an all play, though. This one came in through YouVersion. It says, do you believe intelligent design or any other religious creation story has a place in schools? Obviously, we're in a school now. So is there a place for intelligent design or any other creation story in any school? Mr. Schultz, I'll say first.
Is this on? Okay. So I think Michael and I share an opinion on this, but I'm not sure. I won't speak for him. I have a controversial position for a secularist. I actually think that it would be, in theory, perfectly legitimate to discuss intelligent design in a high school classroom. And the reason for that is because I agree with Dr. Grotes about the fact that it is a scientific question. The concern I have, and I think others who share my opinion, which I'm not the only one that has this opinion there, I know of many scientists that have this opinion as well. My concern about that is that it wouldn't be taught properly because there is too much of a religious agenda behind it. If it were to be taught properly, as in objectively the way a scientific theory would be taught, I'm afraid it would be taught as a debunked scientific theory. And that would probably create problems for even more problems for people in school. And there are lots of examples of debunked scientific theories. Lots of them are already taught. There are examples of N-rays or Lamarck's version of pseudo-evolution and others. I think it's legitimate to talk about failed scientific theories, and I think that's how intelligent design would be talked about.
Well, the question begs the question. It says that intelligent design is the same as a religious creation story. It isn't. It is a theory about testing biological organisms for evidence of design. That is all that it is. And that's how I presented it. So the way it can be presented fairly is to explain Darwinism, explain a challenge to Darwinism, and cite the reasoning and evidence used by intelligent design theorists who are not uniformly religious. For heaven's sake, read Thomas Nagel, Mind and Cosmos. The subtitle of that book is Why Most Likely Darwinism is False. Now, Thomas Nagel is an atheist. So it's not merely religious people that are making this argument. And moreover, the argument that I made was not to support the book of Genesis in its totality. It was to say there's evidence in the biosphere for design. That's the point. And I salute my colleague here for wanting that to be discussed. And I think a good way to do it would be have both sides presented by proponents and make sure that they play fair. So I'm happy to hear that you want that done. If it's ever legal, invite me. Please.
And I would say that one of the things that I think my fellow colleagues have their hands tied behind their back in a sense is that they can't present evidence that contradicts Darwinian evolution. And there's quite a bit of it. In fact, here's a nice book for you. Icons of Evolution by Jonathan Wells. He's a PhD at Cal Berkeley in microbiology. And he talks about all the things that you see in textbooks that people have put in there that you take for granted, like Haeckel's embryos that have been falsified, and most, I'm sure you guys are probably aware of that. But there's a lot of things that are assumed to be true, the peppered moth, that they don't actually rest on tree trunks. So to make the picture, they had to nail the moth to a tree trunk. So yeah, there's a lot of things that are faked in textbooks. So I just want my students to be able to see both sides and the, you know, make their judgments for themselves. I'm not trying to make my students into mini-me's.
Yeah, well, I want to say something more general.
Bring the microphone.
Okay. I want to say something more general. I think that religion should be discussed in school systems, and I think that education is crippled because that can't be done. So, for example, I'd like to see in secondary schools discussion of arguments for and against the existence of God. I'd like to see the teaching of comparative religion. And as regards the sort of intelligent design thing, I'm quite happy to say it's a scientific theory. That's fine, okay, right? I'd be quite happy to see it presented in the schools. But I have the concern that my partner Norm has that it wouldn't be done properly, right? And so I'd be quite happy, for example, to have students read the relevant chapter from Dr. Grotheis's Christian Apologetics, along with the relevant material from Kenneth Miller's book, for example, Finding Darwin's God, right? And there they learn, for example, that one of the things that Behe put a lot of stress upon was blood clotting, right? And claimed that, so to speak, he couldn't give a satisfactory naturalistic explanation of it. And again, he discusses that in great detail, Kenneth Miller, and shows that that's simply false, right? So I think it's good to have a wide variety of theories presented. I think that people learn things better when, for example, they see false theories. And so I think that students have better understanding of Newtonian physics if they're exposed to Aristotelian physics, right? And so if it could be done properly and the material presented objectively and all relevant theories looked at, so, I mean, for example, I'd also want them to consider views according to which the Earth is only a few thousand years old. There's a view that's accepted by about 40% of our fellow Americans, and there's massive evidence against it, right? I'd like to see them examine those sorts of theories as well. Put all those theories in the school system, I think education would be improved, and I would be delighted to see that happen.
Let's do another all play here, so you each get 2 minutes on this. And it speaks to something you mentioned in your presentation, Dr. Tooley. If we're designed by an intelligent creator, why do our bodies contain seemingly useless parts such as wisdom teeth and an appendix? Dr. Brotes.
Okay, the claim that we're making is that aspects of biology, and you can also go into cosmology, as my colleague did, are best explained as designed. Full stop. Not designed by an infinite perfect being. The argument is that there is sufficient evidence to infer a designing intelligence from the empirical evidence. The rest of the argument for Christian theism can be made on other grounds. So the argument I thought was supposed to be about, is there evidence for intelligent design, or does Darwinism, the designer substitute, explain life adequately? But Michael Tooley wants to talk about all these features about Christianity that are definitely false, when that is not actually the issue here. The issue is there any evidence for an intelligent designer? Now, I used to have a gremlin. Some of you remember the AMC gremlin. One of my friends here helped me fix it once. Now, the gremlin was famous for being poorly designed, but no one would say it wasn't designed. So when you look at something like the bacterial flagellum or the informational nature of DNA and RNA, or some of these things, you say that you find specified or irreducible complexity that indicates design. Is it perfect design? Could something have happened to the original perfect design? Is there some aspect of the design that we don't understand? Those are secondary questions. The question on the table, I thought, was, is there sufficient empirical evidence using real solid arguments to infer design? Now, design defects, predation, these sorts of things are not addressed by this aspect of the argument. They can be addressed by other kinds of arguments.
On my handout, under reasons to be skeptical of intelligent design, on my second paragraph, I talk a little bit about what I call haphazard design in nature. And I partially agree with what Dr. Grootheis just said, that the fact that design is bad doesn't necessarily mean that things aren't designed. The problem for me is twofold. One is that the theory is intelligent design. There are many things that are demonstrated, organs and different kinds of mechanisms that are demonstrated in biology, that would take the intelligent word out of that theory. So it would just be like bungling design or terrible design. And there are many examples of these. But the second problem is that, and this is maybe a little bit of a finer point, the fact that those systems exist, instead of speaking to design, actually speaks to evolution, because evolution is not in the business of creating perfect organisms. It has no interest, and evolution isn't anything that has interest anyways, but if you want to speak about it metaphorically, it doesn't have any interest in creating perfection. It just has an interest in generating what is good enough to get the job done. And so these cases of bad design are not just cases of design. The term design there by biologists is used kind of almost sarcastically. It's instead evidence that these are systems built on other systems in a haphazard way, exactly as you would expect with an evolutionary process. So it's not just they don't speak to the intelligence. It's that they don't actually speak to design at all. And we see this over and over with the way systems are built, the biological cost of getting rid of systems that no longer function for what they serve, systems that are co-opted for other opportunistic endeavors. And it's evidence of evolution.
Could you put up slide 15, please? One of the things that 15, yeah, Bill Gates in a nice pose there, says human DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any we've ever created. Now, What is Bill Gates, who does Bill Gates use to create his software? Does he use wind and tornadoes and rain? No, he uses intelligent designers. He uses people to write and to suggest that our DNA is far more complex than any information storage system that we've ever created by our best, most genius designers is pretty amazing. So could you go back to number 14, please? If you took the DNA in a single human cell and you stretched it and pulled it all the way apart, it would be over 6 feet long. The DNA in your body contains 3.5 billion bits of information, and the chances of getting something that deep and information rich, now remember I'm going to go into combinatorials, we had 10 to the 16th seconds, you have 10 to the 80th atoms in the whole universe to work with. The chance of getting a single DNA for a simple life form like a T4 bacteriophage, a little tiny dude that's like Pac-Man, just eats bacteria, is 10 to the 78,000. I'd run out of bees, okay? Can't happen. I mean, it's crazy. Okay, let's go.
Just to comment very briefly on the last argument. It's a bad probabilistic argument, and the errors in that type of argument have been pointed out many times. If you try to calculate the probability of a string of things of a certain sort, right, one method of calculation is just assume a random shuffling and so on until hopefully you wind up with it. The result is going to be the probability that's going to be very low. But if you have stable subsystems and so on, it's a very different matter. If some of the things stick together and so on, and you keep shuffling and more things stick together, etc., then the probability is very different. So it's an unsound probabilistic argument. But to go back to the question, arguments for naturalism, if you can look at a number of things where people think there's a supernatural explanation or think that supernatural events have occurred, and you can show that there's a natural explanation or those events did not in fact occur, right, then the evidence builds up, and it's a cumulative case for a naturalistic view of the world. Now, Dr. Grotheis wants to suggest, of course, there's some cases that can't be handled. But, I mean, if you look at it historically, you know, typically you go back to earlier thinkers, they referred to the human eye as something that couldn't be explained naturalistically. We can perfectly well give a satisfactory account of the evolution of the human eye. Behe thought that blood clotting could not be explained naturalistically, but as Miller shows, that claim is simply false, right? Dr. Grotheis wants to rely on one thing, the bacterial flagellum and so on, right? But the idea is that if you have a number of things where it was claimed these couldn't be explained naturalistically, and you get a naturalistic explanation, then it's perfectly reasonable to inductively to conclude that you'll be able to explain these other things as well. He also refers to irreducible complexity. A number of people have criticized the Behe argument by appealing to irreducible complexity. I was at a conference in Baylor on the nature of nature, and Michael Behe was in the audience, and I indicated why the argument from irreducible complexity was mistaken. The chair said to Michael Behe, "Would you like to reply to Michael Tooley at this point?" And the answer was no.
Thank you. It's time. No, sorry. Dr. Grotheis, this question is for you. Is the belief in God and the acceptance of evolution, are they mutually exclusive?
Well, it depends on how you define evolution. If you mean that nature is thoroughly explicable without design, no, because if we're talking about monotheism, whatever version it is, the claim is that there is an infinite personal God who created and designed the universe and has left some evidence of his design that is detectable. So if you say that everything in life can be explained or let's limit it to biology without design and then say God is the designer, you have a very difficult conjunction of propositions to defend. Now, there are Christians and other theists who believe in what's called theistic evolution. For example, Alistair McGrath is a Christian theologian who believes in theistic evolution. I don't hold that view myself, but the question is, what do you mean by evolution? Do you have to believe, let's say, if you believe the biblical account that the earth is no more than 10,000 years old? I don't think so at all, and I argue that in my book, Christian Apologetics, and I want to thank my colleague, Dr. Tooley, for mentioning my book so many times. I didn't have to mention it the first time. Of course, he doesn't like it, and I do, but That's probably enough on that for now.
Yeah, can I respond to Dr. Tooley's response to my response?
Okay.
Now, he brought up a point that, you know, things stick together, okay? Like, well, you have an Na+, a sodium ion, and a Cl-, and they'll join up to form, you know, a crystalline matrix, so you get salt. But the problem is, it's like a book that you read that goes ABC, 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 ABC. It never gets any more interesting. Sodium and chlorine, that's it. DNA is not like that at all. There is no chemical reason why an A, a C, a G, a T adheres to the base, to the nucleotide bases adhere to the backbone. Otherwise, we'd all be the same, right? So there's no predisposition chemically or chemical predisposition to explain it. Can I have a real quick illustration of this?
So the point is this. You could use the laws of magnetism to explain why these laws are on here, why these letters here, but how did that message get there?
Okay, it's time.
I put it there.
An intelligent agent.
This is your first warning, Mr. Richard. You need to behave on your own. Mr. Schultz.
I wanted to address partially what... is it okay if I call you Stu?
You betcha.
You can call me Norm. I wanted to address what Stu just said, and it's actually something I think is a form of reasoning that is common in creationism and defense of creationism. And it's the God of the Gaps reasoning. And it's mentioned in my sheet right under reasons to be skeptical of intelligent design. And it's basically the idea that when you find that something cannot be explained, that it is rationally proper to assert that that implies some form of intelligence or a god. And that reasoning is known to be poor for many different reasons. One being, it's an ever-shrinking view of what you believe is responsible for whatever is you're looking at. Also, it's improper because for every explanation, technically you create two new gaps. So, my time is up.
Professor Zuri, would you like to comment on that?
Yes. I think that the existence of God is perfectly compatible, not just with some theory of evolution like a theistic theory, as was suggested. It's perfectly compatible with naturalistic theory, right? The problem is, of course, there may be less compatibility with certain religions like Christianity, essentially, right? But if someone said simply a theist believes in an all-powerful, all-knowing, and perfectly good deity, there seems to be no incompatibility with belief in a naturalistic theory of evolution. And I think that a number of Christians have that view. I'd say there may be difficulties depending upon what your view is of the Bible and so on. And Dr. Grotheis is willing to set some things aside and so on, right? And so, calculations were made about the age of the earth, but you can actually go back instead to the age of the earth to the time of Adam and Eve or something like that, right? And you get something like, 4004 BC, the famous calculation, right? And so Dr. Grotheis wants to set that aside, but, other people want to set more aside, right? And they want to say there's no special creation. We can accept the naturalistic theory of evolution.
Okay, thank you. This one's for you, Mr. Tooley. If you could put your microphone just a little bit closer so everybody can hear you.
Okay.
This question is for you. It says, if we evolved from primates, why aren't they still evolving into humans?
Well, evolution takes a long, 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 long time, right? And to expect to see evolution taking place in your lifetime or my lifetime, right, in a significant way, it just ignores what the theory involves, et cetera, right? You require genetic modifications and so on, the natural selection. One of the points about evolution is it does require such a long time. And at one point, that was viewed as an objection to evolution, right? And so... famous scientists argue that the Earth hadn't existed long enough to give time for evolution to take place, okay, right? But that view turned out to be mistaken. Discoveries were made that showed that the argument was unsound, okay? So basically, it just requires an enormous length of time for evolution to take place, right? But you need to look at, people need to look at things like the Relics of Eden by Fairbanks, right? And it includes a number of things. I mentioned the case of chromosomal relations between human beings, chromosome number 2, and 2 chromosomes in the case of primates. But there are a number of other things. There, much of the DNA material is not genes. Genes are only a relatively small proportion, right? And so you have other things that have nothing to do with, so to speak, design of organisms, etc. And you can look at the relations between that material, which you find in the case of human beings, and the material that you find in the case of other primates, apes, and chimpanzees, right? And you find that they're very close relations. Again, this is just unintelligible if you have a view that humans were specially created, right? These relationships just make no sense at all, right? Whereas if humans, on the other hand, descended from primates, then the results that you find there are just the results that you predict on that hypothesis.
Since we still have that cute slide up there of the spoon, I was going to say that does still kind of beg the question of DNA and RNA. And also the DNA piece, the amazing capacity of it suggests nothing other than design. Charles Darwin's mentor was a guy named Charles Lyell, and he wrote a book, Principles of Geology, with reference to causes now in operation. How do you explain information? Okay, that's the problem for the materialist. You can explain maybe certain things, but you can't explain how you get information. That only comes from an intelligent source. You could put the DNA information for every species on the planet in a single teaspoon and still have room left over in that teaspoon for every book that's ever been written.
So the original question was, if we evolved from primates, why are there still primates? And I have to say, I've heard variations of this question, and I personally have never really understood where the question is coming from. It's almost like there is a disconnect of reasoning, because to me, the question is modeled by another question. If America came from the English, why are there still the English? I don't understand the basis of the question. Or if cakes are made from flour, why do I still have flour? I'm just baffled at what the question is even indicating. Evolution is not, again, interested in creating perfect organisms. So you're going to have organisms that evolve simultaneously, they're separated by various barriers, and they will co-evolve separately and lose the ability or just desire to mate. So you're going to have all kinds of, and this is not particularly rare in evolution. It's actually quite common.
Yes, I don't think the question raises any significant problem for Darwinism at all because it misunderstands what the theory is. But the problem really is the nature of information itself in living systems and whether that can be accounted for on the basis of natural law and chance and the combination of natural law and chance. And it simply cannot. Let me refer you to a book by Stephen Meyer called The Signature in the Cell. It is a very fine piece of philosophy of science, history of science, and scientific reasoning. And he argues that of all the extant theories for explaining information in life, some intelligent cause is the best explanation. It is better than seeding by aliens, which has been suggested actually by Francis Crick. It's better than the other theories that are on the table. And it's a very thorough piece of reasoning. So I recommend that book highly in terms of the nature of information in any living system, whatever its place is in the history of life.
Mr. Richard, recently nucleic acids and proteins have been created by the ingredients of quote-unquote primordial soup, an energy that would have been released by lightning. How do you explain Miller's 1953 experiment?
Sweet. Right in my wheelhouse. Okay. Stanley Miller was a graduate student at the University of Chicago where I started off. Edwin Hubble and I have one thing in common. We both played basketball at the University of Chicago. That's it. Nothing else. But this apparatus that he set up was what he thought was the primeval atmosphere on the planet Earth. And he put in hydrogen, ammonia, methane, and water vapor. First, he pumped out the air, which was really fortunate for him, because if he hadn't have done that and put an electric spark through that, he would have blown himself up. Now, it turns out that that's not at all what the early atmosphere was like, as we can see in the rock record. It turns out that pretty much the stuff that comes out of volcanoes, carbon dioxide, things like that are in the atmosphere. And through photodissociation, things like hydrogen and the light gases, they leak away so that we become more and more oxygen rich. And we only have, in our atmosphere, we have 21% oxygen. And we think, we need more trees, we gotta have more trees, let's get higher oxygen. Oxygen's very high in terms of its flammability. I don't know if you knew that, but if we raise it to 25%, if you ran down the street, you would ignite, okay? If you lowered it to 17%, you couldn't carry on higher level brain function. At 15%, we die. We hit the jackpot again and again and again, and it's chance? I don't think so.
Okay. So a couple of things. One is the theory of evolution doesn't apply to this stage of life. The beginning of life is abiogenesis, so it's a different set of theories. And absolutely, that science is in, I think, complete disarray. There are, I think the last time I even looked into it, there are something like 12 different current theories. But again, the idea that because science can't explain something, that means that it's legitimate to put an intelligence or a god in that place is God of the Gaps reasoning, and it's just not legitimate reasoning. And I'm a little bit curious about Stu's position, because it seems to me that on the one hand, he is saying that the universe is completely intelligible, and that's a reason that it's a sign of design. But then on the other hand, he's saying that there are many things that we don't understand, and so I'm not sure how those work together. The fact that we don't understand is actually, to me, why science is so exciting. For me, it creates a real sense of wonder.
Well, a couple times my colleague has said that science can't explain X, therefore we invoke God of the Gaps. That begs the question. That's a rudimentary fallacy. The issue is, there is a science called inference, or a method called inference to the best explanation, and it's used to detect design in these areas that I specified. So the question is whether it does the work. You're begging the question and saying, well, if science doesn't explain it, and what you mean is naturalism. If naturalism doesn't explain it, you go to God, and that is an illegitimate explanation. But I wish I had more time. The God of the Gaps charge fails, because this is a pattern of inference based on increased information of the nature of the cell, increased information about molecular machines and things of this nature, increased information on the fine-tuning of the universe, and there's a pattern of reasoning that is not specifically or idiosyncratically religious. And you also said at one point, well, if you can't explain it rationally, invoke God. That's poisoning the well. Two fallacies.
Okay, so the question was about an experiment in which with a mixture of inorganic molecules, you could wind up with organic molecules, right? And Stu has pointed out that there was a mistaken assumption about the early Earth atmosphere involved in that experiment. But the general point here is that this experiment shows that there are ways of getting from inorganic molecules to organic molecules, and there's an increase in complexity, right? And so the question is, what are the grounds for believing that that sort of process cannot be taken further, right? That you can go from sort of rudimentary organic molecules to more and more complex organic molecules, right? And the fact that there's not a satisfactory theory of the origin of life isn't a serious consideration. There are a number of competing theories at the moment. It's early days, right? And what the objection is to sort of the inference best explanation is that you look at a series of successes, right, and that gives you good reason for thinking that there are going to be further theories that are going to be successful in the area in question.
Mr. Schultz, how does evolution explain morality and the idea of absolute truth?
I actually did my master's thesis on evolution and morality, so this is in my wheelhouse. I don't think evolution does explain morality. I think it has to be explained by different means. My explanation of morality is, I believe in what's called social contract, which is that morality is a social construct, much like money, that is made up to solve certain problems and to make our lives better. So with morality, I think the idea of associating moral judgments with objective truth, if you want to use that term, is a non-starter, because I believe that moral truths are collectively created by wanting to live together well. So I don't see a correlation between those two. And I'm sad to say that when you study philosophy and when you study science, I think one of the things that you conclude is that there are almost no cases of certain truth. Philosophers have certainly had a long tradition of believing that there are very few, if any, examples of certain truth. This was, I think, eloquently and seminally described by Descartes. But that isn't any reason to be worried. The best that we can do is use methods that take our weaknesses and biases out of contention and try to arrive at as close to an accurate view of the world as we can. And I think that the term for that is science. And therefore, as has been emphasized by Dr. Gruthuis, if there is a scientific explanation that does provide the best explanation for something that isn't explained by evolution or another process, I would accept it, and I would cease to be an atheist. I just haven't seen the evidence for that.
When we study the area of science in my theory of knowledge class, one of the things we talk about is the inductive fallacy, that science, of course, is subject to being refined, and that's one of the beauties of it, I would agree with Norm. And that's why I was interested in it. So I heat up metal A, it expands. I heat up metal B, it expands. Metal C, it expands. I therefore infer that all metals will expand when heated. But what's my problem? I haven't tested every metal. And I can't test every metal in the universe. So I have to make an inductive leap. I have to guess that this is going to work. And so that's one of the pieces about science that makes it something that you don't want to rely on as your whole worldview, because it's only part of the worldview. It's a key, and it's good, but it's not everything.
Mr. Rotize for Mr. Tudor? Waiting for the other?
Yeah, go ahead. I want the last word, Michael.
Okay, very briefly. Belief in the existence of God cannot provide a basis for morality. There are complicated arguments, but a simple way of putting it is this, that if there are ethical truths, there are basic ethical truths that do not depend upon in any way upon the way the world actually is, those are necessary truths. And so they hold in all possible worlds. God, on the other hand, is not a necessarily existent being. There's no logical contradiction in atheism. And that means there are worlds where God does not exist. And so there can be worlds where God does not exist, but if there are ethical truths, then they will obtain in those worlds, right? There are other arguments as well. You need to look at what philosophers have done. I have two colleagues, both of whom are atheists. One is Michael Humer, the other is Graham Lotte. Both of them have written books defending value realism. Michael Humer's book is called Ethical Intuitionism. Graham Lotte's book is Value, Reality, and Desire. They're perfectly satisfactory philosophical accounts of moral values.
We've got some for...
Wait, don't I get to respond?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Sorry, you're my student. I can still fail you. Okay. All right, I want to respond to the Darwinism and morality issue. Now, if you're talking about Darwin's Darwinism, you have to consider origin of species and also descent of man. Because Darwin claimed that the biosphere can be explained, at least once you have the first replicating organism, without any design, without any purpose, without any normativity, without any moral bearing whatsoever. What counts is reproductive success, or what is commonly called survival of the fittest. Now, Darwin applied that idea to morality in The Descent of Man and said that what matters really is power to prevail over less fit organisms. And so he said there are favored races, which happen to be white, and there are less favored races that happen to be African races. So the argument is that if Darwin's Darwinism is to be accepted, the implication is social Darwinism, and social Darwinism is morally repugnant.
We've got a couple questions here for both camps. And so what I'm going to do is we'll start with the intelligent design camp, and you'll each get 2 minutes, and then you'll each get 1 minute to respond. And then the next question, you'll each get 2 minutes, and they'll get 2 minutes to respond. So the intelligent design group, the question is, why would God have the dinosaurs exist for millions of years and then kill them off? What is the intelligent design behind this?
Well, if you believe in intelligent design, it doesn't mean you have to explain the design in every detail for every organism. We are finite, limited beings, and we have more to learn. The issue is, do you see evidence of design in life? And I argue, yes, we do. Now, what God's purposes may have been for having these organisms and have them be extinct, I don't know the answer to that, but it has nothing to do with advancing the intelligent design theory. And moreover, if you have supplemental arguments for the existence of a personal infinite God, as I give in my book, then you have a very good case for believing in that being. And if you can't explain specific items of history, that doesn't defeat the overall theory. So I don't think that the theist, whether it's a Christian theist, Muslim theist, Jewish theist, has to give some kind of secret knowledge that God has. You know, what was God's dinosaur plan? Is just irrelevant.
And I would say that one of the things that people often critique is the idea of like the universal flood of Noah. And I see, as a scientist, I see evidence on the top of Mount Kilimanjaro for sea fossils. I see evidence on the top of Mount Everest for sea fossils. I wonder if, you know, a Christian theist climbed up there and just placed those there so that, you know, they'd have something to back up their theory. My point being that things that are in the Bible, sometimes we don't grasp the fullness of them. For instance, Isaiah 40:22 says he sits above the sphere of the earth, the hug. Isaiah wrote this in 740 BC. How did Isaiah know the earth was round? You know, you got to start getting into things like the predictive capacity of the Bible and books like that, because it has so many amazing features that can't be explained naturalistically. And, you know, the idea of dinosaurs, I don't see as a problem. It's, okay, so I'll stop.
I drove by some dinosaur tracks on the way here, and it didn't threaten my faith at all. Sorry.
And all I got was the T-shirt. I think that there's been a lot said about inference to the best explanation. I think that inference to the best explanation is a good way of forming beliefs. It is not without certain problems, but it is a good way of forming beliefs. And the reason why I accept evolution and deny intelligent design, I think, is for inference to the best explanation, because the existence and demise of the dinosaurs, as well as so many other components that are found in the fossil record, found in DNA, found in organisms, in our organs, and so many other areas, are best explained by evolution, best explained by there not being a plan. I mean, at some point, when things happen so haphazardly and so counterintuitively, a plan that is mysterious and there being no plan look identical. And so one of the thought experiments I give my philosophy students is to imagine a universe where there happens to not be a God. And life is generated by some mysterious process. And along the way, that form of forms of life change and eventually become aware and start to think about their origins. But along the way, they've also developed emotional responses and superstitions. What would that universe look like? And I ask them to contemplate what would that the difference be between that universe and ours. And I would challenge people to come up with any substantive answer of a difference between those two universes. And that's why the cases like these, to me, support the evolution, but to support naturalism.
Yeah, well, I agree with what my partner Norm has said. I guess what I would add is, I mean, I don't think that the extinction of animals is an exceptionally strong objection. I think that there are facts about in the vicinity that are much more impressive. So, I mean, one of the reasons that some people are young Earth creationists, for example, is that they think that if the Earth was around for a long period of time, as Dr. Grotheis thinks, right, then you have these eons, so to speak, before human life appeared on the scene, during which there was enormous animal suffering, right? And I think it's very hard indeed to see what the, so to speak, divine purpose could be in that. I mean, the thing we have to realize is that the opponents in this debate are not just people who believe in some sort of designer or other. They don't believe in a God who created life and then wandered off and just let things go any way they wanted, right? They believe in a God who is perfectly good, right? And the problem is that there is a very strong argument, the argument from evil. Dr. Grotheis, in his book, does not respond to my version of that argument, does not refer to it at all.
Second edition.
An exceptionally strong argument.
Okay, so this one is for this camp, and you each get 2 minutes, and then Intelligent Design Camp will get 1 minute to respond. Pasteur promoted the law of biogenesis, that life comes only from living things, not from non-living substances. So, the question is, who falsified the law of biogenesis, by what proof, and when was it done?
I'll take this first because my answer will be very quick. I do not know the answer to that question. And I'm sure that there is material out there that is speculative on it. And I'm not sure how that would translate into a substantive belief one way or the other about our origins or metaphysics or any of the matters that we're talking about.
Well, my answer is that I don't believe, if we use falsify in a strong sense, I don't believe that the claim that life only comes from life has yet been falsified, right? I mean, the question ultimately is whether or not we'll have a satisfactory theory of the origin of life, right? And again, our debate opponents and so on labor the point that the moment we don't. And what I say is very early days and so on, we certainly know that some simple things can lead to more complex things. That's not a matter of disagreement, right? They have the belief, though, that there are limits to this, right? That there's certain things of certain type of complexity that cannot be arrived at by, for example, chemical reactions using simpler components, right? I don't see any reason at all to accept that claim. I mean, given that simple elements and so on, simple molecules can combine to produce more complex ones, right? I don't see any reason for thinking that can't be extended, and ultimately you wind up with molecules that are not just more complex, but have the properties that are characteristic of life.
Well, yes, if we had a good naturalistic explanation for how life can come from non-life, I'd be willing to accept it. But we do not have one, and what the naturalists always say is give us time. And I say there is an explanation on the table, intelligent design, that fits, that is used in other fields, and why not take that seriously if it explains what it's supposed to explain thoroughly? It doesn't beg any questions. But it seems to me that the naturalists, to my right, are saying, well, you've got to wait until we have a naturalistic explanation. And that just begs the question. Maybe there's a good intelligent design explanation, and no explanation is not an explanation. I call it the post-dated check fallacy. If those of you old enough to remember checks.
And I thought of Norm's example of asking his students to imagine a universe. And I often ask my students to imagine nothing. And most of them are thinking about nothing most of the time when I'm talking. But I said, when I close my eyes and I picture nothing, I usually see black empty space, but that's something. The people use the term Big Bang. It's actually a derogatory term that was coined by Fred Hoyle to try and make his steady state theory appeal. But it turns out the Big Bang is not a causal theory. It's an explanation. It's trying to the first effect. You can't get a universe from nothing. All right. So that's a big problem for naturalists. How do you get something from nothing? Because if you know that, I'd like you to invest my stock portfolio.
This is an all play, so each of you gets 2 minutes. Please explain the numerous new species that seem to have suddenly appeared at the Cambrian explosion.
Well, that's not something I brought up in my talk per se, although I was tempted to. Steve Meyer has a new book out called Darwin's Doubt, and Darwin, in Origin of Species, said that his theory had certain problems and it could be falsified under certain conditions. In fact, I think Darwin was a lot more open-minded than many Darwinists are now. And one of the problems that he found was the Cambrian explosion, where all the basic body plans and types of organisms appear in a very short period of time, given the vast expanse of geological history. Darwinism has to explain this on the basis of slow successive variations. This is sometimes called biology's Big Bang. And so if there's a gigantic increase in information that cannot be accounted for on the basis of unintelligent, blind processes that has to be slow and incremental, and which is not recorded in the fossil record at all, then a better explanation for this would be intelligent causation.
I think there is quite a bit of material out that some of it is fairly new that shows that evolution can occur quite rapidly, even with recent experiments. Richard Dawkins, in his book, The Greatest Show on Earth, discusses experiments with guppies that shows that evolution of their coloration and spots and other features can occur quite quickly. And this is also observed in the evolution of populations of bacteria and other kinds of organisms. So I don't think that it is out of the realm of explanation for evolution to accommodate rapid change. I also think it's expecting a bit much to be able to answer a question like that with just fossil evidence. The plain fact of the matter is most of the evidence was destroyed, right? Think of it as a crime scene. It's highly contaminated by now. So there may be things that we never know about evolution or about certain species. And I think that a scientific-minded person is not necessarily uneasy with not knowing some of these answers. That being said, I really don't think that evolution can't accommodate those kinds of changes.
Yeah, I don't know a great deal about this, but I have seen recent shows, actually, and it's clear that the idea that evolution is necessarily slow and incremental and so on, though a dominant idea in the past, is an idea that there are now good reasons for questioning and so on. I mean, so I think it's now known, for example, that rather small changes in genes and so on can have, so to speak, radical effects on the nature of the organism in question, etc. I'm not an expert in this area, but as I've seen TV shows discussing recent breakthroughs in this area.
What was the question? Sorry.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah. It's about the Cambrian explosion.
Oh, well,
yeah. The Cambrian explosion, all the species in Greenland.
Yeah, because it's a very short period, geologically speaking. It goes from about 530 to 525 million, according to the Cambrian dating piece. But the other pieces that we're leaving out, too, are the other parts, the mammalian radiation. Suddenly all these mammals appear all at once. The big bloom of flowering plants. There's a lot of these different pieces that scientists are going, how did that happen all of a sudden? Because if you look at slide 32, it has a little example from the Cambrian explosion, and it shows you, you know, how all these sudden appearance of all these major phylum in the geologic record. But all the things in green and yellow are basically imaginary. Those, there's nothing there. And all those things that Darwin said when he drew in his one illustration in The Origin of Species is the Tree of Life. And he had all these little branching pieces that should have been there, but they're missing.
We had this question in a lot of different forms, so we'll do this in an all play too, so each of you gets 2 minutes. How would you answer the problem of evil, pain, and suffering in the world?
I can start.
Sorry. I don't want to go first because I think it's our opponents who should be answering this problem, right?
Why?
Mr. Richards said he was ready, so why don't you start?
All right. Nobody wants this one. Turns out that from a naturalist perspective, I don't see how you find evil or good, because there is no evil or good in a sense. It's a matter of personal taste, as Bertrand Russell said. You know, that's how I decide what's right and wrong. It's a matter of personal preference. But my question for Bertrand Russell would be, in some countries they love their neighbors, in other countries they eat their neighbors. Would you have a preference? The problem of evil, it turns out to be something that God allows in order to bring about a greater good. Because what would God have to do to eliminate all evil? Well, if I'm at all honest, he'd have to eliminate me. And I'm guessing he'd probably have to eliminate all of you. Has anybody here told a lie? And if you don't raise your hand, you're lying now. Okay, so you just covered that one. But the point is, we're all evil. We all have that propensity. Solzhenitsyn said the line between good and evil runs down the center of every human heart. Every one of us has that problem. But God could have stopped evil by making us robots. But he chose to give us free will to bring about a greater good, which we call love, because love always involves a choice. I couldn't give my wife a potion to make her fall in love with me. I mean, I tried. It didn't work. But the point is, that doesn't work, because love always involves a choice.
Are we doing one side at a time, or can we go back and forth?
So, the problem of evil, I think, is part of the reason why I don't believe in God. But it is often asserted by theists that the way they explain evil is that God has some plan for the evil, that it serves some purpose. And I find it a little bit troubling that a person who is science-minded would accept that kind of answer, because that is an answer without any substance. It's not given that there it is clear what the purpose is, and it is not easy at all to explain apparently pointless evils, of which there are many examples. From the Christian worldview, there are hosts of people on the planet who will go to hell, or will not, at the very best, not make it into whatever world is awaiting for Christians, through seemingly no fault of their own, because they simply were born in the wrong place, or born to the wrong parents. Or even in the United States, children that are born to extreme poverty might not get the proper education that they need, through no fault of their own. There are many, many examples that could be given of apparently pointless evils. And I think that it is a little bit unfair to accept the answer that, well, God has a plan, even though it's a mystery. I'm glad that I don't have to explain the existence of evil. And as far as the wording is concerned, for the naturalist, evil is something that you would not prefer. So it is anthropocentric. Of course, it's centered on our values. And our values have a way of falling into a certain range that makes sense because of how we live together. And if you want to call that an objective basis for evil or good, then I think that that works. And this has been talked about at length by many philosophers.
Michael and I are going to stare at each other to see if this.
Well, I think it's your turn, actually. I think last time.
Their turns?
Yes, your turn. Okay. And the problem is a problem for you. It's not a problem for me. So
that's wrong. Yeah. Every worldview needs to have some account for morality, good and evil. According to Norm's naturalism, there is no objective good and evil. It's all consensual. Now, according to Michael's atheistic worldview, there is objective good and evil based on what you might call abstract objects or some theory that there are necessary truths of morality that exist whether or not there's a God. Now, I disagree with that. I deal with that in my book. I don't have time to deal with that here, and it's just too technical. But on naturalism, there is no such thing as evil in the sense of something that offends the character of a personal being. Now, there might be something that goes against this impersonal standard that Michael believes in, but according to Norm, there is no objective evil whatsoever. It's all consensual. But every worldview is not just Christian theism. If it's going to be worth its salt, has to give some account for suffering and evil. And the Christian account is that there is very good evidence for a creator, designer, moral lawgiver, God. There is evil. Evil is explained on the basis of the fall and sin. And there's evidence in history, particularly in the person of Christ, that the worst evil ever done to an entity, that is to Christ, didn't end in the crucifixion, but actually ended in the resurrection. And there's historical evidence for that. So there's much to be said on this, but I have to disagree with my esteemed colleague that it's only a problem for Christian theism. It's a problem. It's a question for every worldview.
Okay, well, first of all, it's important not to confuse scientific materialism with naturalism. And Stu, I think, has been guilty of doing this on a number of occasions, right? So on a naturalistic approach, there can perfectly well be objective values, right? And as mentioned, a number of colleagues of mine have defended that sort of view. If you were to look at the existing philosophical literature, you'd find a large number of philosophers who are not theists and so on, not religious, defending objective values, and they put forward various sorts of theories. Here's a way of looking at things. Douglas is very keen on inference, the best explanation. And so there's an argument you find in David Hume, and he says there are four hypotheses that can be given concerning things like suffering and evil in the world, right? And so one hypothesis is that the world was created by a perfectly good being, another was created by a perfectly evil being, another that there were both sorts of things, and so on. The fourth hypothesis is the hypothesis of indifference. And it seems to me that if you look at what you have in the world, you have various things that are good and desirable, happiness and so on, you have enormous suffering. You have suffering that predates the mythic fall of human beings, okay? I mentioned earlier all the suffering that animals underwent long before humans were on the scene. So appealing to the fall is, so to speak, a hopeless explanation, right? If you look at the things you have in the world, it seems to me that the most plausible explanation by far is that our world is not governed by either a being who cares deeply about goodness and so on, or by a being alternatively that's completely evil and cares only about that, right? The most plausible hypothesis by far is that indifference, right? If there is a creator, he's indifferent to good and evil.
We only have time for one last question in brief time, so we'll just give you each 1 minute for this one. But several people asked about miracles. Some would claim that there are miracles throughout human history, and specifically in the Bible. What do you say about the claim that there have been miracles in human history?
Well, it's interesting. We're really far afield of what the topic was supposed to be. And this always happens, and they always drag me into it. But let me give you a very short answer. The general probability of a miracle is very low, but the conditional probability for a miracle may be higher. So if you have good evidence that there is a creator, designer, lawgiver, being, that being could work a miracle, then the question becomes historical. Do we have solid historical evidence, or personal evidence for that matter, that miracles have occurred? And especially with the resurrection of Jesus, we have very strong evidence that he rose from the dead using what's called the minimal facts approach. So yes, most miracle claims are likely false. That's just general probability. But if you talk about specific or conditional probability on theism and then probability for a document like the New Testament and a person like Jesus, the probability grows, and I think we can have actually knowledge that Christ rose from the dead. And if he did, that changes everything.
Of course, being a philosopher, I would say you have to define what is a miracle first, but we can set that aside. I think philosopher J.L. Mackey, I might forget his first initials, gave a good description of the situation with miracles. And it's basically that there are two very large hurdles that any claim to a miracle has to overcome.
One is you have to provide evidence that the event in question actually did happen, and that it happened the way that is proposed. And two, you have to give evidence that, okay, is that actually miraculous, or can be explained by some other means? And the probability, when you take into account those two items of rigor, that any miracle is going to stand that scrutiny is vanishingly low. And there have been many miracles that have been debunked, from the parting of the Red Sea to modern miracles of weeping statues.
I would ask Norm how he debunked the parting of the Red Sea.
Well, I didn't.
Oh.
Somebody asked him.
Oh, okay. I've never heard of that one. I've heard of this explanation. I've heard of the naturalist explanation that it wasn't really the Red Sea, it was a reed sea, and that it was only 3 inches of water, and so the wind blew it apart, and so that's why they passed through. But then my question would be, how did the Egyptian army drown in 3 inches of water? That would be an even greater miracle. So the point is that when you allow God in the supernatural, and truth to be truth has to meet three conditions. It has to be logically consistent, it has to be empirically adequate, and it has to be experientially relevant. And I know what God has done in my life and how he's changed me. I used to try to suffocate my little brother over there and when he was a kid and put pillows over his head, and I don't do that anymore. You know, it's changed. So,
okay, very briefly. First point is that the Bible makes claims that certain miracles took place where we have excellent reason for believing they did not, right? Take the case of the Battle of Jericho and so on, where the sun presumably stood still for something around a day in length. If that had actually happened, there would be worldwide testimony to that event. There is no such worldwide testimony, right? Take the case of a passage in Matthew 27, 52 to 53, where it says that at the time of Jesus' death, the graves were opened and the dead got up and walked around. There would have been massive reports of any such event. There are none. It's not even in the other three Gospels. There's a very important book by a writer named White, something like The Conflict between Science and Theology within Christendom, right? And he has a chapter on the growth of healing legends, and he discusses the case of St. Francis Xavier. And what he points out is if you look at later biographies of Xavier, you see references to resurrections and so on. You look at Xavier's own letters, letters as contemporary, there are no such references at all. So these things essentially have been fabricated with the passage of time.
Now we are in our closing arguments, our closing thoughts from each panelist, and so we will go in reverse order from how we started. So Mr. Richard, you can start.
Okay, so I always enjoy the interchange and exchange of ideas, so I want to thank my colleagues over there. Thank you guys for exchanging with us. And I think for me, the key point that I come back to is that it has to change my life and it has to make a difference. And I tell my students, there's only really two ways you can bet in life. You can bet that there is a God, or you can bet that there isn't. Okay? Right? That's it. So I have this envelope thing, and I say, based on the flip of a coin, I'm going to put $10 million in envelope A, or I'm going to put a nickel in envelope B. Okay? Before I even flip the coin, what way does it make sense to pick? Because, let's get to this. If you bet that there isn't a God, and there isn't, that it really doesn't matter at the end, because at the end, there's going to be an end game. There's a one-to-one correspondence between everyone who's ever been born, and we've all died. We're gonna, we haven't yet. So, you can choose to believe that there isn't a God and that there isn't. It doesn't really matter. You know, you can do what you want and choose your own life. But if you bet that there is a God and there isn't, same thing. It's kind of like it's a nickel. But you might have had a little bit of peace and stuff like that, even though you were delusional. But if you bet that there is a God and it turns out that there is, jackpot. But if you bet that there isn't a God, and it turns out that there is, could you go to slide, my last slide? Sorry, I was trying to, it's my very last slide. The very last one. I got a chance to go to Israel. I lead trips to Israel and the Middle East because I speak some weird languages. And the first time I went there, I got to go to the Garden Tomb. It's a place in Jerusalem, kind of a ridge in Mount Moriah. And I was racing around trying to see all these things. And there's a hill there that you can see the skull of what's called Golgotha in Hebrew, the place of the skull. And I went in the tomb and I looked in there. It was pretty cool because the amazing thing was there's nobody in it. And if Jesus' body was still there, the Romans could have pulled it out and nipped Christianity in the bud right there. The Jews could have showed it to these Christians and said, you guys are crazy. The Christians were all scared to death. That's the beauty of the Bible. It gives you the principle of embarrassment. These guys are writing about stuff where they failed. And the beauty is, I looked at that sign and it says, he's not here. He is risen. And that's why we have hope.
Professor Tuohy.
Thank you. Well, we've been talking here tonight about the choice between a naturalistic worldview and a Christian supernaturalistic worldview. And I hope that the conversation we've had has been one that you found helpful. My friend Norm Schultz and I have argued both that there are good reasons for accepting a naturalistic worldview and for rejecting Christian supernaturalism. Rather than summarizing that evidence, what I'd like to do is to close on a personal note by inviting each of you to consider the possibility of a journey that I myself undertook many, many, many years ago. I grew up in a family that accepted Christianity, but who did not attend church on a regular basis. Around the age of 8, however, I decided that I want to attend Sunday school, and I did so regularly. Then, when I was 12 years old, I made a decision to accept Jesus as my personal Lord and Savior, and I joined the local church. For the next half dozen years or so, I had absolutely no doubts at all about my faith. I accepted completely both the moral teachings of Jesus and of the Bible generally. And I also accepted completely, without question, Christian accounts of human nature, of human origins, and of ultimate human destiny, with the alternatives of eternal life in the presence of God, or on the other hand, eternal separation from God, spent in hell. Towards the end of my first year at university, however, I had a conversation with a good friend of mine, whom I deeply respected and admired. And at the end of our conversation, he suggested I read a book by the British philosopher Bertrand Russell. The book was entitled Marriage and Morals. I did that, and when I finished the book, I realized for the first time in my life that one could ask what reasons one had for accepting the beliefs that one did, especially one's religious beliefs. And when I asked myself that question, I found that I didn't have good reasons for those religious beliefs. I'd simply absorbed those beliefs from the environment in which I'd grown up. The result was that I was no longer a Christian. So what I want to do is to ask each of you then to consider seriously, as I attempt to do, the possibility that your own religious beliefs might be mistaken. Now I realize fully that this may not be an easy thing to do, and that the prospect of doing so may be somewhat scary, and that for a number of reasons. For one thing, if you were to decide that your Christian beliefs were not true, how would that affect your relationships with those who are near and dear with you, your family, your parents, your very close friends? Moreover, you might very well wonder whether you would then be able to enjoy a happy life, believing, for example, that there was no God and probably no life beyond the grave. Well, here I can only say that in my own case and the case of close friends that I've known who've gone on that journey, all of us are very pleased indeed that we did so. Among other things, there's a joy in being able to look at the world and see it as it really is, devoid of illusion. I'm very confident then that if you decide that you too are open to the possibility that your present beliefs might be mistaken and decide to think things through, I'm very confident that you will wind up taking that journey and feeling the same way I did, that you've made the right decision. Thank you very much.
Well, the intelligent design side has made the case that there is sufficient evidence to infer design in aspects of nature at the cosmic level, at the biological level, and so on. And we've argued that this is a legitimate scientific endeavor. There is scientific evidence for some intelligent design and some designer. The topic of the debate was not Darwinism versus Christian supernaturalism, but that's what it became, largely because of Professor Tooley's insistence that he talk about that. Now, my journey is the exact opposite of Professor Tooley's. I became a Christian at age 19, not having been raised in a religious household, per se. And I had reasons for becoming a Christian, realizing I was lost and needing redemption through a source outside myself, but I did not have a lot of evidence and argument for it. And I remember shortly after I became a Christian, I went hiking with a friend of mine named John, and he said, "All right, Doug, you've become a Christian. This means you'll spend the rest of your life only associating with Christians, only reading Christian books, and never testing your Christian beliefs." Well, I've spent every year since then, that was 1976, doing the opposite. I've attempted to respond to every challenge, to theism in general, to Christianity in particular, to the reliability of the Bible, and so on, because I'm an intellectually studious, curious person. And in fact, those of you who've had my classes know that I'm the enemy of fideism, which is you just believe, you know that you know and you're knower, and you don't have to have evidence for your beliefs, you don't have to argue against other worldviews. And what I've attempted to do through my book, Christian Apologetics, other books, debates, interactions, and so on, is to say that there are good and sufficient reasons for believing not only in an intelligent designer, that was supposed to be the focus of this debate, but in fact Christian supernaturalism. But that really was not supposed to be the debate issue at hand here. But of course, since it came up, and since Professor Tooley has done me the respect of reading my book, and of course not liking it, perhaps if you are a skeptic or unbeliever, or if you're a believer who thinks there's no evidence for Christianity, perhaps this book will help you. And I'm offering it for no profit on my own. And in fact, if you can't afford it, just come up to me and I'll give you a copy. That might be helpful.
Okay, so a couple of just cleanup things. Stuart has... Oh, is it Stuart or Stu? I'm sorry. I'm going to call you Stu.
Just don't call me late for dinner.
Okay. You've offered several arguments for your beliefs, and I like the way that you presented them. Some of them have names, and I'd like to list three of the names of the arguments that were featured here by both you and Dr. Grutheis. One is Pascal's Wager. So if you're interested in following up on these on your own, you can look up information about that. Also, the fine-tuning argument. And lastly, the empty tomb argument. And these are all arguments that are theistic arguments that there is a rigorous back and forth. In the atheist skeptic community, I think it is generally thought that the fine-tuning argument is the best argument for the existence of God. I and other atheists obviously don't find it compelling, but it is a really intriguing argument and worth studying. And it would be the kind of argument that I would be overjoyed if it was discussed in high school, in any context, really. I think the other two arguments are not as strong, and I'm honestly surprised that the empty tomb argument gets as much traction as it does, because in a simplified version, it seems to me to be an argument of, well, we can't find a body, therefore this was a miracle. And I find that argument to be borderline absurd. If you were to look at it as if it were in a criminal investigation and you were trying to find a body that was 2,000 years old, I don't understand how that has any traction. So I'm surprised by some of the arguments, but some of the arguments are quite, I think, sincere and highly interesting, and these matters are totally worth discussing. I personally believe that intelligent design as a set of propositions is it brings up very interesting questions and provides an attempt to explain answers to them, and I don't have any problem with that. I do think, though, that evolution as a theory is strong enough to respond to those, and in part has already. And I also think that there is too much wish fulfillment and desire on the side of creationism for people to be objective. I find that they will accept shreds of evidence or scraps of evidence, and instead of seeing that it's really quite a weak case. And Freud talks about this at length in his The Future of an Illusion, which is in my sheet of a recommended reading. So personally, I'm open to the evidence. I hope everybody here is, and they will continue their journey in examining this further as you go through life.
Yes, let's thank you. Though they don't have face paint on, they've been in the arena battling it out in this important area. And so great job to each of you in interacting with them. Last thing is that on your program on the bottom, you probably already noticed, but we're just curious to know if this debate, if it influenced you one way or the other. So it's self-explanatory where you were before you came in, and if it moved you any way or the other. Now, don't worry if you fill it out and give it to us. We're not going to be on your doorstep next week asking you to watch a video. We'll be back, all those things. We're curious. And certainly, if you do have questions, if you do are wrestling with things, you'll know how to find us from our website. But we didn't want to do a bait and switch. We just wanted to say, let's talk about this. Let's see that there are good arguments on all sides here. On the back, also on the bottom of that, if you'd like to be contacted about future events similar to this, where we're dealing with current issues, let us know, and we'll just email you when they're coming up. And then on the back, if you're interested in the DVD, we're going to have a professional DVD made of this tonight. It'll just be $10, and so just you can put on the back you're interested, how many you want, and we should be able to get those out to you in the next few weeks. Also, obviously, both Dr. Tooley and Dr. Grotes mentioned his book. He brought some of those, and so if you're interested in those, I think they're back there at the table. So, thank you for coming. Elbow on, there's buckets back there. You'll see people with the buckets. They can collect those forms on your way out. So, thank you for coming.